Hey guys, Charlie here. A quick reminder before we kick off today's episode that Will and I are coming back to the live stage April 7th at the Basement Comedy Club in Melbourne. We're doing another TOEFOP Live. It'll be me, it'll be Will, it'll be special guest Deeksie, most likely, and you'll want to be there. There's a link in the episode description, so check it out once you've listened to this awesome show.
A Listener Production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
Everyone relax, this is Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast and I'm going to be very quick today. Great episode with Eli, you're going to love this. I've known Eli for a very long time now, and what a beautiful young person and comedian Eli is. So I think you're going to love this chat. If you don't know Eli, I've said Eli a lot in the first 20 seconds of this, then you're going to enjoy getting to know him. And if you are already familiar with his hilarious comedy, then I think you're really just going to love this chat. You can catch Eli on tour, so make sure that you do that. Find out if he's coming to where you are and go out and see him. Speaking of being on tour, I am currently on tour and I'm recording this message very early in the morning and trying to keep it quiet so that the neighbors in the place that I'm staying don't get woken up before I pop out for the day. But I want to let you know that this weekend I'll be in Canberra for the Canberra Comedy Festival. Look, there wasn't many tickets available when I was recording this, so there might not be many left by the time you're hearing this, but if you are in Canberra and there is a ticket or two available this Saturday night for Will Legitimate, and then after that, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, and a whole bunch of other places that are all already on sale, and I've got to be honest with you, it's been amazing to have such a great response to this tour, one of the biggest tours that I have ever done in my life, and I'm going to keep going and going and adding places. So far, Brisbane, Sydney, Perth, Canberra, all selling extremely fast. Melbourne selling very well, but there are a lot of tickets available in Melbourne. So come and see me there. Wagga Wagga, Geelong, Wyong, Albury, West Tamworth, Hobart, Cairns, Caloundra and Noosa, all on sale. All on sale already. So if you are in any of those places and you want to come and see Will Legitimate, comedy.com.au is the place to go to find all the information about that. And of course, here in the Everyone Relax feed, you can check out all our podcasts, TOEFOP, TOEFOP with Friends, our AFL adjacent podcast, Two Guys, One Cup is back for the football season. And of course, these regular episodes of Willosophy that come out every week. I'm going to go now. I've got some stuff to do, but thank you so much, as always, for listening to the show and enjoy this episode with Eli. Everyone relax, this is Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show begins. I ask my guest who they are, so simple one to start. Who are you?
Hello, kia ora. I'm Eli Mathewson. I'm a comedian from Christchurch, and I'm coming to you live from Christchurch today. As a fire rages on the Port Hells. So it's, another catastrophe for my hometown.
What, I mean, Christchurch, if you're not from Christchurch, like, you know, the international reputation of Christchurch is that it is disaster related, right? Like, that's what people, when people think about Christchurch, that is what they think about. How bad is the impending fire that you're in, like, at the moment?
I think the latest news is that, so it's been 2 days and they've got it 70% down or something, but it's going to take 2 weeks or something to fully get rid of it. So I was like driving home just before, staying at my mum's house and like on the way, you're kind of driving past like this, we're still recovering from the earthquake. It's been like 13 years, but there's still sections of town which are like nothing, you know, or things have been rebuilt or historical buildings that are just covered in scaffolding. And it's like, gosh, we haven't even recovered from this, and then there's been like five other huge. This is a second fire as well, so yeah, it's a town with a lot going on.
Did you grow up in Christchurch? Is that where you're from originally?
I was born in Auckland, but then we moved here when I was 5, and I lived here till I was 21. So yeah, I grew up here.
Can you remember Like, I, this is not something I normally ask in this show, but it's something I've been thinking about a little bit in my new stand-up show, which is your first memory. Do you have a clear first memory? Can you remember what you first remember? I know that's such a weird question to ask, but like, is there anything that you, like, I mean, do you remember any of your time in Auckland, for example, or do are most of your memories from Christchurch?
No, I kind of do remember Auckland. Like, I kind of remember our house and our sandpit, and I remember mainly horrible things, like our neighbor's dog killed our other neighbor's cat in our backyard, and I remember I remember that as like a first memory.
Yeah, that's a real traumatic first memory, though.
Yeah, but I guess I guess because I moved, I do have this like visual memory of the space and the house, and I don't know if that's from like home videos or whatever, if it's an actual memory. And I remember, this is maybe just as well from people telling me, but I remember our whole family on the plane moving down to Christchurch, and I said, have we left New Zealand yet while we were in the plane? Because I thought we were moving to a whole new country. And that is maybe just in the retelling has become maybe one of my earliest memories of something I said.
Yeah, that people, you don't necessarily remember saying the thing, but people remember saying the thing and tell you that they remember you saying that thing, and therefore it becomes part of your memory anyway. So
yeah,
you went to Christchurch.
I see myself on the plane.
Where are you in the family? Because there was a bunch of kids, wasn't there, in your family?
Yeah, there's five, and I'm the second youngest and the only boy as well. So I feel like, I think I have a little bit of like younger siblings qualities because of being unique just in gender alone. You know, like I got a lot of free reign, both in terms of young age and, you know, oh, he's the boy, so let him try stuff.
Well, it's interesting to me though that you talk about that idea of being the only boy. Did that mean that you think you did more things that were traditionally female aligned because everybody else was, right? Or was it that idea of like, you're the boy, therefore here are these list of boy things that boys do. We're going to make sure that he does these boy things.
I think it's almost like an even split of both. Mm. Like I loved dinosaurs. I went to see, I guess this is my earliest memory maybe, is that My older sister had been to see Jurassic Park. I was four, and then she told Dad it was good. So then he brought me and my other sister, who was six, to see Jurassic Park, which is obviously like 2 and a bit hours long and incredibly scary. And I kind of have a memory of like the scene where the velociraptors are walking through the kitchen. We were crawling through the cinema. Like, we felt like we were in the kitchen. It's kind of like my first, definitely my first movie memory. But yeah, I was into dinosaurs. I loved Thomas the Tank Engine, so I was into trains, but then also, yeah, there was like dolls everywhere and I played with all the dolls and just lots of role-playing games with my sister. And often, I think I sort of saw myself, when we would play Jurassic Park, I would always want to play Lex, who's the girl, the young girl who's the hacker on the computers. So I wanted to, it was almost like I wanted to be the girl in the boy stories.
I'm interested in the younger sibling. Like, I mean, you're down the bottom of the youngest siblings here, right? Like, if there's five and you're second to last. Somebody told me the other day that they thought that, you know, people in show business often are younger siblings because you need to fight for attention. Was that something that was part of your growing up, that, you know, being that far into the mix, fourth of five, that you needed to, you know, you needed to attract your own attention?
Yeah, I think, yeah, make a bit of noise and stuff. And also, it was also the fact of like instantly feeling like I had the attention because I got a lot of privileges. Yeah. Like I got my own bedroom before anyone else did because of having a penis. You know, like that was essentially the reason. So there was like a lot of attention and like extra questions. Yeah. Like, obviously all the girls want to do this, but we better check in and make sure Eli wants to do this as well. So I feel like I relished in the attention that already was given to me.
When you were a kid, were you interested in like performing? Because I mean, you seem, as an adult, you're one of those people that I met you, you know, you were already a performer at the point that I met you. And even though you were setting out on your performance journey, like when we first crossed paths, mm-hmm. was very obvious that you were in the right place. Like sometimes you look at young comedians and you think, eh, maybe you won't be exactly here, you know, in 10 years' time. And then some you're like, mm-hmm. oh, well, you seem to have found yourself exactly where you need to be. And you always had that sense. Like, so were you a performer from a young age?
Yeah, I was thinking, preparing for this podcast, I listened to previous episodes and I was like, gosh, when did I figure out that I want to be a performer? And I've got this like very specific memory, which is when I was 9 for the school, you know, everyone has to do a school speech. And maybe in the previous years I'd done what the teacher told you to do, an introduction, a conclusion, all the normal speech stuff. And then when I was 9, I basically just did a roast of the Spice Girls. I just did this speech about who the Spice Girls were. And I was like, here's what they look like. And I drew on the whiteboard like these hideous beasts. And I was like, and here's some of their music. And then I pressed play on a CD player. It was like the sound of like vomiting, basically. This is like roast of the Spice Girls at 9 years old. And it killed. And I felt so good. And the reason I know that it killed is because the following year, a bunch of kids kind of tried to do almost the exact same speech. And I was like, wow. So it's been done, kids. It's been done. The roast of the Spice Girls happened.
Even at age 9, I mean, that's a legacy piece. If you've got other kids coming through thinking that's now the perceived standard of what the school speeches need to do.
Yeah.
What were you like at school? Like, I mean, were you that sounds very precocious. Were you a precocious kid?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I used to impersonate. We had this show on TV called Serial Stuff, which was like part of the kids' program, What Now? Basically, it was like Serial. And when the characters were indoors, they were played by the hosts of What Now? And then when they were outdoors, they were Barbies being like moved around with hands. Okay. And that influence, like I just loved that show. I thought it was so funny, and I used to kind of impersonate the characters at lunchtime. And I would like write plays for us to perform. I remember writing like a Batman play, and then like we did it in class one day. So I was a little bit precocious, and also like a very social butterfly kid. Like I didn't really have my like one group. I used to kind of move between lots of different groups.
Okay, so that's interesting to me. Like, what was it about, like, I mean, what made you a social butterfly, do you think?
I wonder if it was kind of from growing up in a big family, maybe was part of it, or I mean, maybe it was just a desire to perform to several different groups.
I've got to keep moving. I've only got so much material, and I've just got to make sure that I spread it around a little bit.
Exactly. Maybe I realized if I had lunch with different people every day, I could do the same yarn, but get some good results.
I mean, well, that's essentially the idea of touring. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly.
Lock that in from an early age. And you talk about like the performance being part of it, obviously from a pretty early age, like you said, like, you know, doing, you know, impersonations of this TV show, but like getting people to be involved in your plays and stuff. Did you find it easy to recruit other kids to be part of your things? Like, you know, if you're writing a play about Batman or whatever, was there a group of willing participants? Were you the cultural ringleader of, you know, these kids, do you think?
Yeah, you would find that a lot of kids would want to be involved, but on the day they weren't. They weren't at the performance level they needed to be, or they were chicken out. Yeah, I think I had like two really good friends who were at primary school and intermediate, and then one of them came to high school as well. And when I look back on us, like that group, who were probably the people that I hang out with outside of school, we were like super oddball, like gender-wise, height-wise, we looked like completely random people, but all love to perform, and it all are queer now as well. So I feel like, you know, even at like 7, 8, 9, we already kind of found that little community, which was nice.
Yeah, so that's okay. So that's interesting. So you feel like you had a community of, you know, people. I don't know even like what the right way to describe it at that point is, but as you said, people who ended up being queer people in their life were, I imagine, you know, like, I mean, I don't even know how to necessarily put words to what it is that I'm trying to ask, but did you feel like there was a sense of What was the community that brought you together? What was it that was that stickiness that you were able to find each other?
Yeah, I feel like it was like doing things like school plays and speeches and stuff like that, and recognizing the enthusiasm and it is just one of those interesting things, because you see lots of like the groups at school and they often look alike, the people who hang out together, and we definitely didn't. But then to now realize we had like that one core, very core thing in common, and obviously identified it early is quite an interesting thing to think about.
It is, yeah. So when you talk about school plays, and so let's take the Spice Girls roast is like, you know, a first marker that we can all remember. But when's the official first, you know, like school performance or public performance that you get involved in?
It was probably at church, to be honest, I think.
So were your family religious?
Yeah. So we would go to church every week and go to like camps together. And I used to go to Easter camp as a teenager. And we definitely did. Maybe my earliest memory is like me and my family performed a kids' book for the church camp at Wood End Camp in Christchurch. And it was, there's a story about like a possum with a poo, like this, and it was not a religious piece that we did. It was like either story of a mole or a possum that's got a poo on its head or something. And we did that for, it might have just been me and my sisters. Yeah, I think that's my first kind of school play. But it wasn't until I started doing theatre sports, really, that the kind of like idea of theatre became a thing that I wanted to pursue, which was, first year of high school.
Was theatre sports, was that a high school subject? Like, was it part of like a drama course or something like that? Or was it an extracurricular thing that was happening?
It was like a lunchtime extracurricular thing. But in Christchurch, it's got quite a, the idea of improv's got quite a stronghold, because there's Scared Scriptless, which I think is, it's basically the same age as me, I think, the show. And Cal Wilson was one of the founding members of it. And it's been going for every Friday for like, for 35 years. So and that bled into like a school competition that was very competitive. And there's a cup. And I guess Christchurch is the right size that that competition can exist. And people are very invested in it. Yeah.
And so did you take part then? I assume that you took part in this competition.
Oh, it was literally everything to me. I think because I'd grown up watching like Whose Line Is It Anyway? It's probably like my like core comedy watching memory as a kid. And then when I found out that you could do it, I just beyond the four guys that were doing it on TV, that there was a whole world where you could do it. Yeah, I was like, immediately, that's what I want to do. It was like a couple of lunch times a week, maybe one after school practice. And I think there's probably years at my school, at Rickerton High School, where it like became very like a very serious thing, and then years where it would go out of fashion. But when we were there, we took it so seriously.
And how were you at collaborating with other people? Because this is like, I mean, you are a young man who clearly has star quality all over you. You've like everyone, you're still the talk of town about this Spice Girls roast that you've done, you know, you're a promising young junior. You're like one of those kids that I've identified, you know, at a very young age and said, we've got to keep an eye on this guy. Now you're going through the system, the local, you know, competitive theatre sports scene. So were you the star of the team? Were you or were you good at collaborating with other people? Like, what was the nature of, because at high school, very different to, like, you get older and you understand the importance of collaboration and what it means to be a good collaborator. But I'm interested more what your understanding of that was when you were a high schooler.
Yeah, I kind of needed to be disciplined a little bit in terms of, I think, because also just the way it panned out in our theatre sports group as well, there was like two guys, me and my friend Tom, who would do it, and then there was like 20 girls who came along to theatre sports practice. So we were the only boys, and I think I was just a classic show off, always wanted to show my stuff, always doing stupid, silly accents. And we did our first year and it went well. I think we made the final. And then in the second year that I did the theatre sports competition, our tutors actually kicked me off. I was the reserve player. So I did get to play like one of the competition nights because I was sick. But then when they were in the final, I had to watch from the audience, which was a real, probably a really necessary lesson that I needed to work with other people. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see this. Like, I mean, you're painting a good picture. I can actually see how all this is working. So
yeah.
What were you like at school in general? Like, I mean, so what was school like for you in Christchurch when you were like a, you know, particularly as a teenager, what did it look like outside this theatre world that you've painted the picture of already?
I think it's where I started becoming like a hustler, because basically I arrived at high school, not a whole lot of friends from intermediate and primary had come. So I only really had like one friend in my class, and spent the first year being very shy and nervous. I was, I think, the shortest person in my year. I was really, really short when I was in year nine, which is when we start high school. And then slowly, and it was too shy to get involved in much things, like theatre sports was the one thing that I did. And then as high school went on, I started to get a little bit competitive, and I started to be like, and this is maybe like going to bleed into life philosophy stuff, but I was like, I think I'm only here once and I've got to make the most of it. So I just started doing like every extracurricular thing that I could do except for sports. But I did like every other thing that I could do, was always going to like different meetings, or I was on the like environment committee, and, you know, just started trying to do it all. And also any opportunity to speak in assembly, I was like, get me there. I want the spot.
I want the stage time. I'll talk to you about the environment. I'll talk to you about knitting, but I need to talk to you.
Yeah, anything you want me to promote, I will be in assembly. I think especially because you know that so much of assembly is going to be dry, that I'm like, I'm going to bring a little bit of spice if you just give me the chance.
I mean, that is the thing about an assembly, is that it's a low bar. It's like the tennis. You know, I always think when the easiest gig in the entire world isn't like a stand-up comedy gig. It's being a professional tennis player doing the most mildly amusing thing, because like the audience at the tennis has such a low bar for what is the height of comedic sophistication, that like a player running into the crowd and sitting next to somebody and having a sip of their drink is essentially George Carlin doing his seven words you can't say on television as far as a tennis crowd is like concerned. Yeah. So assembly has the same low bar. It's mostly boring. So if you can bring a little razzle dazzle, like king of the playground, for your funny lines that you got away at the celebrity. So I'm interested in this young man that is emerging, like, you know, through joining things, understanding that there is a life to be lived and a life to be talked about. And you said that it starts to cross over in a Venn diagram sense with life philosophy. So while we're here, no point willingly ignoring this moment. Let's jump into it and ask the question, like, do you have a life philosophy? Does it, you know, does it start back then? Does it relate to back then? Tell me how you'd answer that question.
I think it probably does kind of launch in high school when I was about 15. Like, when I was 15 was when I kind of stopped going to church, kind of, and did kind of decide for myself that I didn't believe in it, essentially. And then also simultaneously, that was when I really started doing as much as possible at school. And I think it's a joint thing of like, that life is temporary. We only get this one. You got to live this life as if this is the one shot. Even if there is something after we die, you don't know. So make the most of this. And also, like, in terms of, because so much of religion is like following these specific rules. You know, there's all these specific things you're supposed to do to please someone up there. But I was like, well, I think the one thing we should be trying to do is like more net good than bad in your output of your life. So if you can have more positive influence than negative, that's surely a win.
So if you think about that, then the comfort of religion is pretty simple, which is that they tell you what the rules are. Right. Whereas if you get rid of the religion, but you still want to live some sort of life that has, you know, parameters, like you said, around net good and net bad and all these sort of things, you then have to put a value judgment on what those things are. You are now the person who has to decide, yeah, what is a good thing, what is a bad thing. You don't have anybody else like writing it down in a list of rules or whatever for you to follow anymore. So how did you start making those decisions around what you thought were good things or bad things, so that you can, you know, have this tally of net good things or bad things?
Oh, I guess I just always just wanted to have a positive influence on people, like include people in things, try and make every try not to gossip and bitch about people, just lots of stuff like that, I guess, and pass on opportunities and skills, you know, like, so when we became senior theatre sports players and we were like kind of stars of the school and stuff, I was like, it's as important to be like doing this as it is to be kind of looking at the next generation and like, you know, seeing potential in people and bringing them along into this thing that you love, passing the things that you love on to other people.
So that can be a tough one for people, because often when people get some level of authority or power, wherever it might be, in whatever structure they're in, there is a temptation for people to protect it, to hold it all to themselves, to keep it for themselves. Like, have you found it easy in your life to be somebody who does, you know, see the value in sharing your part in that journey, that there is things that were passed down to you that you are able to pass down to other people? I mean, it's easy to say those things. The things that you've said out loud right then are all good things to say out loud. How easy are they to live?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know if you're living like that 100% of the time, but
Here's what I will tell you. Nobody's living like that 100% of the time.
Exactly.
So that's an impossible standard for any of us to hold ourselves to.
Yeah. I know that I've been in positions where, because I was gifted like TV writing gigs early on from friends who were already there and who needed someone to come in for a day, and then that opportunity was given to me. And likewise, I've hopefully been able to do that for other people as well, some younger people who were just starting out, who then I became in a position where I could help bring them into paid, maybe the first paid writing gig, and help bring them along and bring them into rooms that they haven't been into before. And even in terms of, yeah, the one way I have hopefully paid it forward is encouraging people to try stand up, because I know a lot of people from like theatre and improv, and there were a lot of my friends who I was like, there's this whole world here which you have so many skills that will apply to, and it's going to help sustain your career if you can enter this field where you've got this skill which you can just pop up and do anywhere without a costume or anything. So, yeah, I hope there's quite a lot of people that I have encouraged to do stand-up who now still do it, and I hope they are thankful that they're part of the community now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good thing, though. Like, I mean, I like that you highlight this. These are good areas, right? Like encouraging people to, you know, be able to join something, giving someone an invitation to join something, or at least opening a little door for them to be able to, you know, walk in by themselves is a really important thing to do. Like, it's a nice thing that you put that up the top of like a value system for you. So tell me when you joined the stand-up comedy community. We like, let's go back to that. When do you do your first, like, what we can call a stand-up gig? You know, when do you go from the world of improv and, like, you know, roasting the Spice Girls and making speeches at school assembly and stuff like that to actually doing something that is more traditionally defined as stand-up comedy?
Yeah, I think I thought about it for ages, right? I thought about it for so long, and there was like one clip of Sarah Silverman that I just used to watch like over and over again. And I loved like every joke. It's this comic relief, like 5-minute YouTube clip. And then basically did theatre sports at school, left high school, joined the Court Jesters, doing Scared Scriptless every week. And then when I was there, there were a few people in that who would do these stand-up gigs at the Ducks Deluxe. And so they would always be like, I think they were on like a Tuesday night, come and watch. And they were dreadful gigs. Like, the stand-up comedy scene in Christchurch has taken a long time to get anywhere. For many years, it was like there was the Buskers Festival, and like they would do, randomly they would always do like a all dudes and then an all women line. They'd do like comedy divas and like comedy dudes, you know. But I would go watch that, and I was like, I'd love to try this. And then I would go to these gigs at the Ducks Deluxe and think, I never, ever want to do this, because there would always be like 10 people in the room, miserable, and just like all the acts were doing very depressing gear. using it almost as therapy.
Yeah.
Then I had this like itch to, because through doing improv, I started doing theatre, like, and kids' theatre, and I was like, oh, I think I want to be an actor. So I then applied and got into an acting school in Auckland, and then maybe a month into doing that, I was there with James Roque, who's a comedian as well, a great New Zealand Filipino comedian, and I think he was in the middle of the Raw Quest at the time, and he was like, you should come. And that was, yeah, watching a Raw, he was really crucial, because I watched it and I was like, I think I would be at minimum in the top three acts if I did this. And that was the inspiration I needed to try it for the first time.
But you know what I love about that, though, is I often say to people, I say, go to a comedy room and what you'll realize is that you're not in the bottom three acts. That's what I'd mm-hmm. always say, is like, you'll realize that you're probably, if you've got any sort of talent at all, you'd be like, I reckon I could be fourth worst. And fourth yeah. worst, nobody remembers fourth worst. I would argue that no one remembers probably third worst. They're only going to remember at most the worst and the second worst. And even then, probably not, right?
Like just the worst.
Yeah, right? But like, I think yeah. that but you've gone, you know what, I reckon I could be top three here. I like that. I like that you're already got that level of ambition.
I was too confident, really.
So where did you actually then start? Like, when was the, like, and how did you start? Because, I mean, did you write a routine? Like, I mean, because you had been doing school speeches and those sort of things. So you knew how to, you weren't like just one of those people from improv who'd only done improv who suddenly needed to do stand-up comedy. You had that structure of being able to write and create something as well. Did you write something specifically for your first set? Can you remember what it is that you wrote and what you wrote about and where you did it?
Yeah, I did. And I guess I'd had experience emceeing improv shows where I would normally tell a story. I don't know if I really knew what a joke was. Like, in the terms of the way I would write a joke now, I definitely didn't think of it in terms of jokes, but I thought of it in terms of things that I wanted to talk about. And the main bit, and I just ran it at like lunchtime for my friends at drama school. And then the main bit that I did was about Pandora bracelets. It was about, I had a friend who like, she had a Pandora bracelet and she had all these charms and she was constantly showing me like all the charms that everyone else had got her and implying that it was time for me to buy her a charm. And so the pressure to buy a charm was pissing me off because they were like minimum $70. So I was angry about the Pandora bracelet. Mm-hmm. And then this is like, I can only remember really like one joke from this routine, which was that I wanted to buy her an ugly Pandora charm. I was like, I'll make this worse for her so that I buy her an ugly one. It's so ugly, she never wants to wear it again. I searched on the internet. They didn't have any except for an ugly duckling one, which I bought. I was like, that's enough. And then it arrived and it was a swan, which is actually a massive spoiler for people who don't know that story. It was the punchline, which is like so the softest joke. But it was my closer.
And you didn't worry about the fact that obviously there was too many comedians on the scene already doing material about Pandora bracelets that you would be.
Yeah, that didn't put me off. I know it seems hack now, yeah, but
such a common topic. I love that. That's your first. So, I mean, I actually do genuinely find joy in that this is your first comedy topic because it is so specific. Like, it's so specifically what you thought was amusing and an amusing angle, and it isn't like there's no consideration of relatability. Like,
no,
the choice of this is like a top subject to be talking about.
I'm sure so many people did not know what a Pandora bracelet was, no. And I don't know if I would have explained it well enough for any of them to know what it is.
you do your first gig. Does it go well? I mean, you've got all this stage time, you've got all this experience, you've got, you know, charisma. Like, does it go well immediately? Like, do you find like that it's something that you immediately have an aptitude for?
Yeah, it was. I was very lucky. It was Steve Wrigley was emceeing a Kiwi comic, and he identified like a group of my friends in the room at the top of the show and talked to them. It was like, "Who are you here to see?" And they said me. And I think I was on like seventh. So he just kept building up the fact that, you know, a classic bit that lots of MCs do, which is like, your friend's coming up. If he's shit, all of you guys are going to look bad, basically. And then it went really well, which is good. But then I had that classic thing of like, yeah, the next. A couple of weeks later, I came back, did my second gig. No friends in the crowd. No. Died on my ass.
No friends, no big build up from them. So, harsh reality.
Harsh reality of my Pandora bit just on its own without as much love in the room.
So, when do you decide that? I mean, and it's not like you've exclusively done stand-up, you've continued to do all these, you know, like in various forms, like, you know, all these things that you're interested in have been part of your creative life. But I'm going to say to you this, you're a very good stand-up. Like, I mean, I have watched, because I would not have seen you do like modern day stand-up. Like we met, you know, well before, you know, you were fully formed as a stand-up comedian. So
I was a little baby.
Yeah. So I rarely do research for this podcast, and look, but I did in this regard. I thought, you know what, I'm going to watch some of your modern stand up that was available for me to watch. You know, and fuck, man, like, good. You're very, very good at it. Like, you're a really good stand up comedian. Like, you know, you just like very charismatic performer. Know how to tell a joke. Really fun. You know. I mean, much more relatable on a broader scale now, but still with the joy of someone who would pick a Pandora bracelet as being a good comedy topic as well. You know, there's a specificity to things that you find amusing that elevate, you know, some of the more, you know, general observations to something that is actually, you know, unique and very much your own, you know, specific take on something. Like, how did that happen? How did we go from Pandora bracelet to, you know, you? And I mean, how do you even identify as, I mean, I mean, artistically here, do you identify as a comedian first and foremost? Or if someone asked, do you talk about yourself as being a writer or as being like a radio host or as being an actor? Or like, what is it that you, if you're asked that question, how do you even like, you know, identify as a creative person?
First of all, thank you so much for saying all those nice things. That was very, just a delight. That's very, very kind of you. But I kind of do know sort of like how it happened, I guess, which is that I just kept doing those rookie nights, did the Raw Comedy Quest. And then in my last year of drama school, I kind of knew I wanted to do an hour the next year. I'll backtrack. Basically, me and my friend Hamish Parkinson, we got together and wrote a play, which was called Square Eye Pier. It was like a three-person show. It was the two of us, and then and then Brinley Stent was in one version, and another friend, Elise, was in one, and we put that on for the Auckland Fringe. We'd never put on a play before. We got given a slot last minute, but then we were really lucky because there was like a Best in Comedy award, and Rhys Darby was one of the judges. And so him and his wife, Rosie, came. They saw us. They really liked the show. We won the award, and then they were like, you guys should come to Edinburgh with us. And we put on that show at 2 p.m. and then we would sell Reese's merch and like help babysit their kids and do all this. So it was kind of when I went to Edinburgh, like I've been doing more stand-up on my own, but then I went out and just saw so many hours. Like, we were at the Gilded Balloon, so I just would watch every show that was on. I actually, Celia Pakwala was on there doing her show about her like long distance relationship, and I went to see it like three times because I just thought it was such a good hour. And it was so, you know, it's so cool looking back when you see someone at that kind of stage. She was in like a 100-seat room, you know, and now she's like obviously one of the most famous people in Australia, but back then it was like you got to be so up close. And like, yeah, I just really was won over by the power of these hours of comedy. And so ever since I left, then I came home, applied for the Billy T, and got nominated and started, wrote my first hour, which I'm sure.
Now, for people who don't know, like the Billy Tee's been referenced on this show before because had a bunch of Kiwi comics on the show before, but I don't think we actually ever have fully broken down what it is, you know, and how New Zealand comedy works in that regard. So what is the Billy Tee for people who aren't familiar?
Yeah, it's an award that is quite has changed around a lot, because when it first started, it was like the only New Zealand Comedy Award. So it was kind of recognising the best performer of the year. And I think there was two winners every year at the start. And then eventually it moved because they added in the Fred Dagg Award, which is now the best New Zealand show in the festival. And so the Billy Tee Award is kind of like a newcomer award, but you can't get it for your first show. And once you've done your fourth, it's too many. So it's for your second or third, I think. It's really complicated.
I mean, that's great.
And you have to audition. So you go, there's like a panel of judges, you pitch for them, like who you are, your comedy goals, what show you want to make. And then you do like a showcase where you all do 5 minutes. And then there's basically like a 6 month stretch where you might get some extra performance opportunities. And then in the festival, all the Billy Tee nominees are on in the final week. And then on the Sunday night, they do this show called Last Laughs, where all the Billy Tee nominees perform and the award is given out. And the last couple of years, that's been televised as well. So it's like quite a big exciting thing. Yeah. And then you win your towel and your money, and the tradition, like early on, a lot of people would use that money to go and do Edinburgh or go and do Melbourne. And like that's how Di Hemel went over and Reese Mathieson, and a lot of people, yeah, it was like the launch to go overseas.
And so you come back and you decide this is going to be like, you know, this is part of the New Zealand comedy industry journey, right? Like every industry has their own versions of these various different things, you know, like they might be around festivals, they might be around the industry. There's these little, and they might be different from state to state, from country to country. They're never, you know, necessarily exactly the same. They work in different ways, but everybody has a version of it. So this is the structure in which you understand New Zealand comedy works. Therefore, this is what you're going to throw yourself into. So,
yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. So we pick up the story there again. Tell me what happens next.
Well, what happened next, you were crucially involved in as well, because that, I think in 2012, I'd been to watch Fan Fiction Comedy and I didn't know those guys. I didn't know Rose or Heidi or Joey yet. And I was like, I want to be in this show. So then it was like a personal goal to like try and get involved in fan fiction. And I eventually got a spot, and I used to do songs in fan fiction. And then when Rose couldn't host anymore, I started hosting. And then because you were so generous at bringing us over to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, then I came into the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And I guess doing that show, fan fiction is really built in one of the things that has been like a long-standing part of what has kept me in stand-up, and is like a collaborative nature of like all, you know, being in a little squad and working together. And so then, yeah, I came to Melbourne. I would sit by the river and watch people practice rowing, and I wrote my first hour in a little journal every day. Then we'd do fan fiction.
I mean, is that really what you would do? You would sit and write that first hour down by the Yarra River in Melbourne during the festival?
Yeah, that's where I wrote it. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible. So what was that first hour about? Like, what was it that you were, I mean, what was it that you thought it was going to be about when you sat down to write it, and what did it end up being about?
God, it's hard to even, it was called Proposition Great, which was a pun on Proposition 8, which was like the gay marriage objection that had just happened in the US. It was like, and I don't think anyone even knew that was the title. Oh,
that's so perfect. Like, it's so perfectly overthought. You know what I mean?
I know. It's just like, no one would, it was only for myself.
No, I understand it, because obviously I put my name in the title of all my shows, and I have a big old list of various, you know, show titles, and I have favorites, and sometimes they don't get used because I don't think that the reference is relevant. And there's one I've always wanted to do, a show called Willibuster, based on, you know, filibuster, the American term for, you know, when people do that sort of, you know, constantly talking in, like, I thought, great name for a show, but it's like an American reference. It doesn't really work anywhere, but I'd have to explain it so often that it's not worth the effort of going to. But Proposition Great, I relate. I understand.
I'm glad you relate. I think Will of Us has got legs. I think enough people have heard of the word, you know, if they don't know what it means.
Oh, yeah, I know. But that's exactly the area in which it lives, that enough people have heard about the word but don't really know what it means. So you sat there and you sat by the Yarra and you started writing this one-person show.
Yeah. And that was a real, like, coming out era show, I guess, as well, because I sort of starting stand up and coming out were kind of like around the same, in the same kind of like 2 or 3 months of each other.
Oh, okay. So like when you say coming out, do you mean coming out publicly or do you like mean even with your friends and stuff? Like, I mean,
even with my friend, even to myself, I was like, I was like trying to make it work with girls up until July 2010 and then did stand up for the first time in August 2010 and then in maybe September or October came out. Like, that's the timeline.
Okay.
And so, and then I didn't come out on stage for a bit. Like, all my material was about like Pokemon and all this, like, all just geeky stuff for so long. And then started talking about it on stage. And the, like, at New Zealand in this time, like, apart from Ursh, there was like, there wasn't gay comics. There was no gay men doing stand-up. And so it just became all I really wanted to talk about was that. And because it was still very fresh to me. Yeah, so the first show was sort of about, like, getting my first boyfriend, going on holiday with him, coming out. Yeah, just all the gay stuff. And I tried to do, like, I think I did some song. Like, I used to really do, like, a bit of songs, a bit of sketch, a bit of, and then slowly fell out of love with all of those styles of comedy and just centered on just talking.
Yeah, so why? Why did those other things go away? Like, why did you not end up being like a, you know, a cabaret artist or whatever it might be, you know, as opposed to like, you know, a straight stand-up, I was going to say.
Straight
like,
Yeah, I don't know what, like, because it's not about necessarily what type of comedy I enjoy, because I love watching like really like off the wall stuff. But just for me and my work, the thing that gives me the most drive is just like crafting good jokes. And so, and the simplicity of the form is, I guess, what I love about it. And I think, and especially having gone to Edinburgh, that was like the thing that I came home so inspired by, was like, you can go on this whole journey and, you know, there's not even a lighting effect, you know, there's no sprinkles to it. But yeah, it took me a while. Like, I did a whole show 1 year that was mainly sketch and just slowly figured out that I didn't like it. I didn't like doing it.
So much of your comedic worldview, you forget, like when you say something like there were no gay men, you know, or, you know, very few gay men doing stand-up comedy in like New Zealand at the time, it feels so foreign, even that thought, because things have advanced so quickly in many ways in the last, say, decade or so, particularly. I mean, you know, like, with my TV show this year, we were just doing the stats on guests at the end of the year, and like half of the guests we had on the show in the year, like 16 or 17 of our guests had all been like, you know, queer identifying people in whatever regard that meant, right? Like, you know, half of the people on our show, you know, to the point where that sort of thing is just not part of the conversation anymore. Like, it's, you know, that, but that we forget sometimes that if you went back 10 years or 15 years, that that wasn't necessarily how things were, that like, you know, and so when you first start out on that journey talking about, like, you know, you see it generationally with people who, you know, you see it with, like, for example, and I'm speaking, you understand what I'm talking about. I guess I'm trying to contextualize this for people who are listening to it. But often when I first started doing comedy, if you were an Asian comedian, you had to make jokes about being Asian that often relied on stereotypes that might have been negative about your race, right? That was like the first, like, kind of group of people who come in as some sort of outsider to whatever the mainstream narrative is, often your comedy has to rely on a negative stereotype about that. There doesn't seem to be many negative stereotypes in any of the work that I've seen. Were you very like proudly out on stage from the start, or do you feel like there were jokes that you made that were like sort of self-deprecating or negative at the start because you felt like you had to ingratiate yourself with audiences? Like, do you understand the question that I'm
asking?
Yeah,
no, I know exactly what you mean. I definitely found it was like a learning curve of learning to trust that the audience would keep listening to me if I didn't hit them with a joke that normally, and I feel like traditionally a lot of my jokes, like opening jokes when I was first starting out, would be like, okay, I'm going to let you know that I'm gay and I'm going to immediately say something which is like subverts that, or which is, or at least is such a big laugh that you are going to trust me right away. And I need to do that in like 10 words, you know, because I was so terrified, especially because of just the vibe in so many stand-up spaces at that time, which was just like, you know, you immediately know that you're different and that people are going to say, oh, the gay one, when they are recapping the show to their friends, you know. And I did do a lot of stand-up in a lot of spaces with some real lads who I would just push so hard, and probably did do some jokes that kind of veered into stereotypes. And the best thing to happen for me in my work was like a flood of gay people coming into the stand-up arena, because it happened. And I realized not only could I relax a little bit, but I also couldn't rely on easy jokes, you know. Like there's so many other gay acts that you can't just do the same sort of material.
And so how do you then start? Is it just then about that idea of, because what I would say now is you talk about the world, and part of your world is that you are gay. If you're talking about having a partner or whatever, that person is going to be a man, you know, like, but it isn't like there isn't that sense of my material is about being gay. My material is about my life and my worldview. And part of that is that I am gay. Like there seems to be, that is where you are now. Was there a point, like, was that a gradual thing? Do you feel like it just like, you fully just became that at one point? Was there a point where you, like, was there one joke that you held on to for too long that you needed to get rid of, which was the one that connected you to the past, you know, that you're like, I'm not doing that one anymore, and that means that I'm, you know, like really stepping away from this as a, you know, stereotype or cliche or whatever it might be?
Yeah, there was like my opening joke for quite a while when I was starting out was basically being like, I'm gay, and then using that as permission to hit on a woman in the front row, you know, a joke. And that was like such a crutch. And like, I'm so glad there's no footage of that joke. It's not good. It's not good. But I mean, it's still, I'm like, it's kind of a constant battle as well, because you do get feedback, especially when you do TV stuff, of like, people talk about like gay jokes, but then it's like, I'm just talking about like me and my boyfriend bought our first house. I'm just talking about buying a house, and we happened to be men while we did it. You know, like so many times where, as soon as you mention it, sometimes people are like, this is a gay joke. But I'm like, no, this is just a joke about what's going on in my life.
That definitely is. And so then, I mean, the audience is always going to, like, you know, that woman tells too many jokes about being a woman, where you're like, well, actually, like, you know, or women just talk about this all the time. That used to be the cliche, right? They just talk about this all the time. And you're like, well, firstly, men are talking about their cliche things much more than whatever you're identifying. But secondly, you've got to step to the point where you're like, well, I'm just talking about my life. And if you want to perceive, like, my conversation about like buying a house or moving in or whatever it might be as being a gay joke because I am gay, then there's nothing you can do about that. But how about, you do share personal, your comedy is about your life, you know, like often the stories you're telling or the jokes that you are telling are about real life things that you are going through or that have happened to you. So how do you choose what is for stage for public consumption versus, you know, what is just for you and private to keep to yourself?
To be honest, it's been a learning curve of learning that I need to leave some things out because, and I think that maybe that's like a religious upbringing, growing up in the closet kind of thing where for so long there was so much that I felt like I couldn't talk about that once I was able to talk about it, I had a microphone, I was like, let's all go. But then I've certainly gotten in trouble for saying things on a podcast or in stand-up that then the other people involved in the story have been like, Eli, you need to talk to people before you, before you just go for it like that. So I honestly feel like most facets of my life I've ended up feeling comfortable talking about. I'm sure there's definitely certain areas or things that happen where I'm like, I'm never going to bring that up, but also usually they aren't funny. I'm like, if they're funny enough, of course I'll retell them. And often it's maybe a story that has happened to me and then I've told it to other people socially and that's when I'm like, oh, maybe there's something in that story. Maybe that's a bit.
Oh, so you talked about the religious aspect of it. Obviously, you know, that idea of you know, that you haven't been able to talk about something for so long. So then there's that aspect of like talking about it. But also at the very nature of talking about these things is because you weren't allowed to be your, I mean, I think part of being your authentic self would have been rejected by the religion that you were growing up with, I imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah, like, definitely.
So how do you then, as an adult, do you reconcile that? Like, are any members of your family still religious? Like, was there any pushback against you being your authentic self from, like, the religious upbringing that you'd had? Like, was that a problem in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my family's very liberal people and they all have, like, their religious foundation has always been in helping others and they all do jobs that help other people. Oh, yeah. And so when I came out, the only person who, when I came out, who didn't have an immediately positive reaction was my dad. And that's because he then came out 10 years later. So he was going through his own thing at the time. But yeah, I feel like one of the reasons that I like doing comedy that is honest about all the true things that happen in my life is, because I think sometimes we don't talk about things enough, and that's maybe like the hang-ups that I have in life are because of people keeping secrets. You know, stuff like sex education, people don't tell you everything. And then later on, you're like, I just wish anyone had been open about this stuff.
Yes.
And like, so Chris Parker and I did a documentary a couple of years ago about porn. And the idea of that was just to be like, the reason the porn world is so corrupt and there's so many people living bad lives is because everyone pretends they don't watch porn. No one's talking about it. And that was something that we had both talked about in stand-up and talked about in a podcast. And not that we all need to share all of our personal porn habits, but I think like anytime you're pretending something doesn't exist and not talking about it, that is bad for the planet.
Oh, I mean, it's the classic with, drug laws and education, right? Like the drug laws and education and whatever it might be fine if nobody was doing drugs. But the truth of it is that like, regardless of what you put in place, there's all these people who are still doing drugs and instead of them being able to do it in a safer, better educated way, they have to just like learn whatever it is from their friends and guests and all these sort of things. And that's what you're talking about. It's that discrepancy between if the rules or the lack of interrogation of a subject stop people from doing it, then that's one thing. But when it comes to porn or drugs or any of these things, you're like, yeah, a third of the searches on the internet or whatever it is are porn related. Like,
yeah,
the idea that we're not talking about these sort of things is not helpful to the overall conversation that is trying to be had here.
And not at all.
In the darkness is where the exploitation can happen. Right.
That's, yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. It's
there's also like a weird bit of joy. Like, but I think one of the reasons both of us landed on doing material about porn is that like growing up gay and you maybe there's like certain websites that you went to that you would never talk about with anyone. And then in stand up, you name the specific website, and then you can hear the familiarity from the people who've like, oh, no one's ever said that out loud before. You know, like, there's such a joy in finally someone saying out loud something that you've spent years revisiting that website or thinking about that thing.
Well, particularly because, I mean, Nate Valvo tells a hilarious story about essentially his dad, you know, him coming out to his family by accident, not understanding how internet searches work, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that, like, you know, with any child and their sexuality, generally there's a level of like shame or whatever attached to the feelings they're having. But if you're also dealing with the idea of not necessarily being able to live authentically in who you are or have the structures in place to deal with what it is that you might be attracted, you know, to, or like, you know, then I think that adds a whole different layer on top of it as well. And so, so when you talk about your work then, like, you know, this documentary, there were reasons to do that you've expressed. Like, do you think about that when you're conceiving, you know, like you're doing a stand-up show, like, do you, when you're starting to put together a new stand-up show, is there a thought behind it? You know, is it as simple as I want to, like, just to use the porn joke as an example, because it's just there, right? Does it start with I want to talk about porn, or does it start with, you know what, I think there's something bigger than this idea that I can express in a, like, a line or a routine? Like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Which comes first, the teenager watching the porn or the...
I think it comes pretty quick. I normally center on just usually a story I want to tell or a thing I want to talk about. So I did a show called Faith, which is about religion. I just knew I wanted to talk about religion. Yeah. I did a show called Year of Magical Fucking, which was basically I'd just broken up with my boyfriend and I was like, I think, and I was like going through a period of like sexual rediscovery, I guess. And I was like, I think that's what I want to talk about in this show. And then there's just certain, I'm mainly trying to think of a story, not thinking about what I want to say. Normally what I want to say with the show is the kind of final piece of the puzzle as I'm putting it together. Like I'm doing a work in progress show here in Christchurch, and I've just got a list of jokes. There's a core story that I know is the core story of the show. There are some themes emerging, but I'm not sure what the kind of like drive at home part of the show is. And usually there is, in my stand-up, in like 10 minutes from the end, maybe I'm like, here's the point of the show, and now I'll do one more joke. Is kind of like how they work traditionally.
This is very much time capsule stuff, right? In that, because I am fascinated in this. I often say to people, if you want to see what I thought the show was, you've got to come on the first night, because after that, it's going to change. It's going to change based on audience feedback, and it's going to become a collaboration between me and the audience. But on the first night, you get to see 100% unmitigated what I thought the show was and what it was about. Yeah. I have never been 100% right. This is what I can also tell you. In my 30 years of doing this, I am always some percentage of right and wrong, and it varies from year to year. At the moment, and this is not and this is why I say time capsule, I just think this is a fun, it is February the 15th or 16th today, 16th, right? So what do you think the show's about now? And I only ask you not to get you to lock it in, but more as a, then when people come along and see the show and see what it eventually is, we get to see either what you see, whether you were right or whether you were just completely miles away. If you just had to be put on the spot now and ask what you think the show's about, what's your best guess at this point in your process?
Okay, great. I'll preface this with saying, when I come to Melbourne, I'm doing the show about when my dad came out, which is a finished show that I've played.
So it's already, okay, well, in that case.
That's done.
Yeah, okay.
But,
if you come people listen to this in New Zealand. Are you doing the show in New Zealand?
No, new show in New Zealand, which is what I'm trying tonight. Yes. And the story it's centered around is that my boyfriend had a really bad night terror where someone that was staying with us unlocked the door at like 2 a.m, they'd come home from a party. He freaked out, thought it was an intruder, tried to climb over me, thought I was also an intruder, and then put both of his hands on my neck and then realized what was happening. And
Yeah.
That's the kind of story that I'm going to talk about in the show.
That's a great story. That's a great story.
Thematically, and there's no, this is not articulated in any way in the material I will present tonight, except that I might kind of just at the end, the last 10 minutes kind of describe the themes. But we've bought our first house, right? We've put security cameras up, and since we've bought the house, we've been robbed 3 times.
Are you serious?
Yes. Yes. And the security cameras just mean that, like, in one instance, we're in Melbourne and we just watched it happen live and couldn't do anything about it. But I think what I want to talk about is the nature of, like, owning things for the first time, because I've obviously been, like, a comedian. He's been a student up until quite recently, so we've never, like, owned anything. Now we own a house. We've bought this furniture. We, like, we've got possessions, and I guess the fear is that once you start having possessions and you own land and things, you the danger of becoming politically conservative is looming over the top of you, because now you're worried about things like crime. So even though I am a hardcore greenie, you know, there's this danger now that I'm like, and it is anxious, and there's crime around us, and because we've got a national government in New Zealand now, I'm like, we are going to save some money because of their policies. And even though I know that I'm not politically ever going to go that way, the fear is hanging over you of conservatism.
I know. I mean, I think that makes sense to me. It's inherent in this. I mean, the idea of property being the major thing that, like, changes people's political, like, you know, when you have something, you suddenly need, you're like, hang on, someone else might want to take my something, and there should be rules against them taking my something.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where it starts. Like, you know, that's where you do get, like, you know, a society that operates how it operates. But it also, more broadly, there's that next step, which is, do you start acting conservatively? Do you, in your, like, life, start making decisions that have more to do with continuing to be able to pay your mortgage than they do to, like, pursuing your artistic creativity or whatever it might be as well? Like, there's always that aspect of conservatism that can come with those responsibilities as well. You can't just say, fuck it, I'm going to do a show where I just, like, you know, dot, 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 or whatever it might be, because you're like, hang on, I've got to make sure that I keep doing good work and I can keep paying the mortgage and I can keep... You were doing radio. You're not doing the radio anymore, are you? Like, so radio...
No, I did it for a year.
Radio always, it feels like a classic example of one of these things where, like, it's a good media job where you're like, oh, well, this is, like, a good conservative choice in that, like, it's a proper job. You get paid weekly. They pay you when you're on your holiday. Like, you know, like, it's like a real job. Like, you know, that you can guarantee your mortgage payments around. But also, in a creative sense, can often be incredibly draining for creative people because you're on a treadmill of having to be funny every day, and it's incredibly disposable, and, you know, you don't get to activate that true creativity where you're making the work that you're really proud of, but you're too exhausted to be able to access that creativity because you're using an underlying level of it on a daily basis to do one of those jobs. So I imagine something like that, like a media opportunity like that, must be... You must get a lot of confronting emotions around that at this stage of your life, where suddenly you have a mortgage and these sort of things, where you go, what do I do with my creativity? What is the purpose of my creativity? My creativity is not just my passion, something that I'm pursuing now. It is also the way that I pay my bills and set up the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, interestingly, I don't know if we would have been able to buy our house if I didn't have the radio job when we bought it. You know, like, that probably helped the bank. But yeah, the radio thing was kind of, ultimately, thinking about it now, a good strategic move for me in terms of career, because I'd done a lot of writing and, done a lot of writing work, and I sometimes felt like I was seen as a writer first and a performer second. And then when the radio opportunity came up, it was like, that was because someone who'd been in that seat on that show for like 25, 30 years, I think, was leaving the job. And so it was like a big popular show. And yeah, I had a friend who worked doing the afternoon show, and she kind of like got put me in front of the thing. And I guess I kind of knew all these things. I knew from friends who had done radio that it kind of sucks your life away, that your creativity's gone, that there's so much expectation placed on you. It was 2022. COVID was still rife. Live touring opportunities were not what they are now. And I kind of was like, this is right place, right time to do this job, to boost my profile a little bit. And then, yeah, so many other career opportunities came out of, I think, that boost. So it was a hard, yeah, hard, hellish year. Even though I loved the people I worked with, and like I liked the format, and lots of it was really fun, but the hours were crazy, and it just depleted every area of my life. Like, tired on my relationship, barely ever saw my friends, couldn't gig as much. Yeah, it was a beast. And I really admire anyone who's able to maintain a full-time radio career and do comedy on top of it. I'm like, they're quite hard schedules to align.
They are, and people do tend to do them. And look, I've had periods in my life where I've crossed over those two things, but they've always ended in me saying this is unsustainable, you know, because of the reasons I outlined. But I'm interested, so you're not bringing a new show to Australia, you're bringing the show about your dad coming out to Australia. And, I mean, we can't mention – that can't be brought up without me asking a follow-up question, or people who aren't familiar with you in this podcast are going to say you've really driven by what seemed to be quite a major plot point in this, which is – so let's talk a little bit about that, because it is an interesting story that your dad – in context of your coming to Australia to do this show so people can come and see the show, but what can you tell us about your dad coming out? And, where's a good place for us to start in this that doesn't spoil your show?
Yeah, well, maybe I could just, like, the night that it happened, like, it was something I never thought would happen, right? Like, my dad is not into, like, his hobbies are not traditionally gay things at all. Like, the music he likes, it's like Bob Dylan and Neil Young. He's always loved cars, which is a thing that I talk about a bit on the show. And he has gone to church his whole life, and used to take me to rugby games and cricket games. And yeah, it just was not something I ever saw coming. And so the night that it happened, I was really stunned and shocked, very proud of him, but like also couldn't believe it. And also immediately, I was living with Alice Sneddon at the time, and I came in and like lay on the floor and was like, I can't believe what's just happened. But immediately I was like, I'll probably do a show about this.
Of course.
Which is like, that's the terrible thing about being a comedian, right? Is that like a huge live moment can happen, and it's one of your first thoughts is like, this isn't going to be an hour.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of those things where you're like, well, start making notes. Like, I'd be like, this is a big moment, but can I just push record on my phone for a second? Because exactly. I'll need to remember exactly how all this went down.
Yeah, exactly. But it's been a cool thing. Like, it's definitely brought us a lot closer. And my family spread all over the place, like a few people in Christchurch. I've got a sister in Spain, a sister in London. My dad lives in Auckland and has for the last few years. So we've spent a lot of time together. And, you know, like even like the queer community is not that big in Auckland. So there's plenty of events where we independently decide to go to the same thing. My dad's in a gay choir. Like, my dad is almost more actively really doing the work as well than me. He goes on lots of marches. He sends lots of letters to politicians. He just the other week, he sent a complaint letter to TV3, which is like the TV station I work for, about something they did on TV. I was like, Dad, just consider my career, please. Yeah. But it's nice. He's got a partner now. They're looking for a house together. It's pretty amazing to see, you know, someone you've known your whole life is one thing, and then, you know, actually something else has been going on at the same time, which is not to say they're a different person, but just like you have a more fully realized picture of them.
Have you had the opportunity, obviously, you mentioned, you know, that when you came out, that maybe Dad was the one who was, you know, least enthusiastic about the whole thing. Have you guys spoken about that since then, like, you know, through the context of what you know now? Like, has that been something that you've actually talked about?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. He's just mentioned basically that, you know, obviously what was going through his mind at the time, which is that, you know, almost like I was doing and expressing something he never thought that he was allowed to say out loud or speak about. Yeah. And I should mention as well, it was only like, he basically didn't say anything when I told him. And then the day later, he took me out for dinner and then was like very enthusiastic and like has always, been good friends with all everyone I've dated since then and stuff. So, you know, he's been very supportive since then. But it's a funny thing to have been an example to your parent, I guess.
Right.
Not that Dad might never have come out if he hadn't seen me, but that is true. Like, if he hadn't had someone close in his life go through coming out, you know, he could have potentially gone forever without ever saying it out loud.
Well, certainly if your experience had been nothing but terrible, right?
If you were
sitting around going, I want to do this thing, whatever it might be, you know, for whatever, whoever it might be, and the only evidence of you, like, that you have in front of you is someone else who did it and it went terribly. Like, if you went, then I think that would certainly make you hesitant.
Yeah. But that, and I guess that's part of that, like, life philosophy thing as well, of putting out net good, which to me is sharing honestly a lot. And that,
because you don't know, right? Like, you were sharing honestly yourself, and you didn't know who you were speaking to necessarily. I mean, there's other versions of your dad that might be some young kid who likes your comedy or whatever who's growing up going, I hear someone who's putting voice to ideas that I think about, or who referenced that website that I've been going to secretly that I haven't been able to talk about. But you didn't know that it might be like your own father in your own home in that circumstance. That might be somebody that you're also talking to as well, by just trying to live your authentic life. It gave someone else, you know, more permission, or at least more encouragement, that they could get greater joy from living their own authentic life. I mean, it's rare that you get that opportunity to do that, I think, in general, for your parents in any way.
Yeah, definitely. So that's a pretty special thing, I think. And
how did your dad feel about you writing a show about it? Like, I mean, because, I mean, this is one of those areas where you do have to consider that there is absolutely another person who is involved in this, and, you know, that this story, like, I mean, yes, you have the right to tell your own story, but you're also going to be, in doing that, very much telling somebody else's story. So how did your dad feel about that?
To be honest, I'm so lucky in that he like loved it and was happy for me to talk about it, you know, like, and I think
might as well get the word out there, son.
Yes, exactly. It's like, do the publicity for me. Yeah. You want to put up a picture of me at the end and let people know.
This is what he likes.
Where to find me. But no, I mean, I honestly think he probably saw that show like 4 or 5 times. Like, he's been to see it so many times.
Yeah.
And I mean, he loves to like sit outside in the foyer after a show and tell my friends the bits that he remembers differently. He's done that for all of my stand-up shows, but particularly for this one. Yeah. He loved to hang around in the foyer. And even if there were strangers who would come up and be like, they'd be like, hey, like, great show. Thanks. Yeah. And then Dad would launch into all the bits that he felt like I'd...
I don't reckon that mean I'll try to be it when he's telling it.
Exactly.
When you talk about comedy and remembering things, it's an interesting topic. And last year in the comedy world, for people who don't know, there's a good comedian who's been on this podcast before called Hasan Minhaj. And people who might not know his work, he was basically the guy who was next in line to host The Daily Show. Seems to be what the word I've heard from those who would know these things. And then The New Yorker did a bit of a takedown hit piece on some of his stand-up comedy and, you know, dates and times and whether some things happened or didn't happen. And there was a bit of a discussion that would happen around then, the idea of emotional truth versus, you know, actual truth, and how far as performers we can, you know, stretch the idea of what is true or what is not true, or whether you can tell a lie to tell a bigger truth. And obviously these are things that you have to think about when you operate in the world of comedy that you operate in, which is that you are telling heightened versions of real things that have happened to you. So what's your thought on that topic, and how do you go into something, you know, around how true things need to be for the stage versus how they happened in real life?
I think my core belief for comedy in general is that nothing has to be true. You know, like stand-up is like stand-up's like the unlimited potential of stand-up. For me, when I'm writing jokes, I try and stick, like, as long as the truth is funny, and if I can make the truth funny, I will stick to it, I think, is my strategy. Like, I will embellish things a little bit, or move timelines around, move events closer together. One time something happened to my boyfriend when I wasn't there, and I was like, can I tell that story and just say that I was there when it happened?
Yeah.
So little things like that. The Hasan Minhaj thing, I mean, that was, it sounded like there was some people that people could find who were being villainized in the show, who maybe weren't villains and have public roles.
Yes.
If I'm right. So yeah. that feel like a crossing of the line, maybe.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I mean, I do think that, like, if you're talking about really specific events that can be identified as not happening the way that they happen, then, I mean, you're putting yourself in a dangerous area as opposed to, like, telling some story as if you were there, like, that happened to your boyfriend that no one's really going to care about, that you, if you were there,
that,
or you heard
there,
it secondhand,
yeah.
It actually just makes it better to, or as I will often say to somebody, I say, yeah, and then they say, did that really happen? And I said, yeah, it happened, but it didn't happen with the funniest bit at the end like I've told it. Like, that was me. I've told it in that pleasing to your eye and ear way that you've just enjoyed. But it did happen.
Yeah. I'm like, that funny thing I said, I didn't say that at the time. But a few hours later I thought, I should have said that. And now I'm going to pretend I did.
Or I said that at the start. But I've moved it to the end because it's much more satisfying if the best thing I say is at the end and not at the start. So I have some standard questions that I ask people on this show, Eli, and I would like to ask them of you. What do you think happens when we die?
I actually love this question because I just occasionally when I'm just randomly when I'm watching a movie or probably too hot, if I'm a little bit too stoned, I just start thinking about if we do live forever after we die, and I really dread that. I dread the idea of living forever.
Yeah, no, I don't want to be accountable for the choices I've made. That doesn't sound a good idea.
Haunting. And I just don't want to have to find things to do. You know, even if I'm just a spirit, still you need things to do. Weirdly, the one idea of the afterlife that I like is from a movie called K-Pax, which is a Kevin Spacey movie, unfortunately. But he talks about, he's like an alien that comes down. The vibe is he knows the secrets of the afterlife. And basically he implies that at the end of your life, you just started again. And you will make all the same decisions you made the first time. So you were just going to live on repeat the same life. No. And so that's kind of a comforting idea to me in a way of like, just live this life well and then you'll do it again infinite, if there's anything.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, I like quite like that, the infinite loop theory. Did you?
I did have this haunting idea once of like you die, you're in a room with a small TV and a VHS and you put it in and you press play and it's every time anyone's ever talked about you and you just watch
God,
it.
God, Eli. That's, what a nightmare.
Yeah. I know.
Would you expect?
Sorry to share that.
No, that's horrible and that's going to haunt me forever. But like, would you expect if it were, I mean, that's essentially like what the internet was for a while, right? Which is there was this weird period, and I always like, particularly with celebrities, it still occasionally happens with like a big celebrity. I don't think so much anymore, but there was a period of time where big celebrities were going onto social media and discovering for the very first time in their entire lives that people did not like them. Like, you know, like they'd become a big celebrity and up until that point they'd had someone hide the hate mail, you know? Because everybody gets, like, the bigger you are, the more chance there are that people love you, but also the more chance there are that people have a negative reaction towards you, right? And they had lived in these bubbles in which they were only being told about the positive reactions that people had to them and then didn't realize that if they said something dumb on social media, everyone would tell them that they hated them. And so there is some element of like the shock to the system that if you found out what other people were saying about you, would you look forward to, do you have a positivity or a negativity bias towards that? So say, for example, your horror nightmare scenario is actually true. You get sat down in front of the TV and you get to watch every time that people have said something about you. In your brain, does it immediately go to a positive place or a negative place? Would you fear the negative things you were going to hear, or would you feel positive that you were like, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to hear, like, you know, this might be actually really fun and lovely, and people are going to say nice things about me.
I almost feel like it would be kind of exciting to see, like, if people misinterpreted one of your or like which things, you know, when you talk about, I can't believe this person said that.
Yeah.
And they maybe have not even clocked that they said anything that anyone reacted to. To me, even if it's negative, I'm still like, it would be delightful to know which moments have had the biggest impact on the gossip circles. What's been doing the rounds?
Yeah.
A lot of people have been like, oh my God, I can't believe Eli did that I actually can't even remember doing.
I was trying to get that information out of a friend of mine the other day for a joke that I'm writing, and I said, like, if you were writing a roast about me, like, just what are the topic? Like, what are the go-to, you know what I mean? Like, I just want to know, like, what are the cliches that other people, like, what is that? You know, I mean, because, there is a curiosity. I said, I'm fine. I understand that I'm a human being, so that, like every other human being on the planet, at some stage, even my closest friends have gossiped about me, said negative things about me. Just what is it? What are the key areas? If you had to rank them, like, what are people's go-to areas about me? And I could
that
not.
That should be a Wikipedia section. Just like go-to roasts.
Just tell me what the go-tos are. I want to know what the specific ones are. Yeah, I think there's a curiosity in that. So, Eli, what's the best or worst piece of advice that you've ever received in your life? I love bad advice, but good advice is fine as well.
This is like a piece of performance advice. And I heard a few different versions of this. This is bad advice. I think, which was, one older New Zealand comedian, I remember, he told a group of us, you should always wear a suit when you do comedy. And then also, and then similarly, there was a thing
you
that
know
I was,
what I love, by the way, is, it just, like, people will be hearing these at different times, but I just, like, before talking to you this morning, I just spent 2 hours talking to the wonderful David O'Doherty, and he literally, when I was asked about a piece of bad advice, told me a story about being in Montreal doing a gig, and afterwards the old headliner told him that he should iron his trousers because people have come out to see him do
it.
So just the fact that I've got those two, like, back to back within the space of 3 hours of me having conversation with someone who's in Christchurch in New Zealand and in Dublin in Ireland, and it's literally been pretty much the same piece of bad advice.
When I was first doing improv as well, there was like a big rule for the show, which was that you're meant to dress like you're on a first date. That was what they would say. It meant was that and we were all like 18-year-olds with no fashion sense. So everyone wore these like hideous dress shirts with jeans and like nice, like everyone looks so bad because they were trying to dress like a certain thing. Whereas I think the more I've done comedy, I'm like, dress like who you are.
Yes.
As long as your phone's not in your front pocket, you are good to go is how I think you should dress for stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I agree with that. But you have a style, like you have an individual like style on stage. Like it definitely, you have a look, you have like a way that you carry yourself and present yourself that definitely, did that just naturally develop as you naturally developed your own look? If you're talking about the idea of being yourself or on stage, is like what you see on stage, which developed, which led the other? Were you starting to kind of develop your own style, you know, the way you wear your hair, the way that whatever it might be, off stage first or on stage first? Which led the other, do you think?
I would say on stage. I would say I think I started thinking more about the clothes that I wore and the way I presented myself when I was used to host You Live, which was like a music video show. And I think I would be on it 3 of the 7 days of the week. And so it would just, I would just have TV days where I would wear my favorite clothes, and then on the rest of the week I would look like a slob. And then more and more I realized that I should just treat life like I was treating that, because actually people see you even when you're not on television. People are looking all the time. So, but it's been more, I guess what I am subscribing to is not necessarily dressing to impress, but just in things that I want to wear. They like just seek them out, more and more, especially in the last like four or five years, maybe I've really like honed in on like clothes that I actually like, that I feel comfortable in, that I know I can move around in, but also look good. But I just think the idea of doing it for someone else is like is a misdirect, I think. It's got to be what you feel best in.
Yes. So I'm interested in what you haven't grown into yet. So we've talked about all the things that you have grown into, whether they be your performance style or your career choices or, you know, your sexuality, your life, you know, the stages of your life. You're growing into all those things, right? Like you can see the progression, you becoming who you are, sharing it with someone else, establishing roots, all these sort of things that you're doing. What is it that you haven't done yet? And it can be in relation to anything, work, life, love, I don't know. But like, is there something that is still like a marker of growing into your own life that you think, and you know, 5 years from now or 10 years from now, or yeah, this is what I see me doing, or this is where I want to be, or this is what I want to have achieved or done at that point?
Oh my gosh. I don't really know. I'm not very good at goal. Like I do set the goals, but not very long term. I'm always like, this is what I want to do next, is where my mind is sitting.
How do you decide that then? Like, how do you, like when you say, oh, this is what I wanted to do next, if you're a person who, because when you say, this is what I want to do next, there's a thousand different choices of what you could do next. How do you make the choice about this is the thing that I'm going to do next, as opposed to the 99 other choices that I have?
Well, I guess I should, like I guess the radio thing was, I was like, I'm going to spend the next year proving that I'm a performer, that people should see me as a performer as much as they see me as a writer, if not more, right? And I think I've had a couple of times, like, so I was nominated for the Billy T in 2013 and 2015, and in 2014 I felt like I was falling off the radar, and so then I just had this goal to be like, I want to prove that I'm one of the best stand-ups of my age at the moment. Like, I just worked hard at that. I just often set those sort of short-term goals. And I think that my short-term goal at the moment is to prove that I can be a touring comedian, especially in the world that we're in now, the way the TV is going. I'm like, I kind of want to, and I know that I'm good enough to make performing be a regular stream of income. So that's, you know, that's my goal with coming back to Melbourne and the way I'm working on my new show. I'm devoting a lot more hours to it. Often it would be like at the end of the day, like often I have a full-time job with the whole of January, February. This year I've spent a lot of time, more time crafting the show and crafting my gear. So the thing that I wanted, I mean, I've never done like a big proper tour. I've always just done little bits here and there. And so I guess one of my goals is to do a big tour maybe.
If you had the opportunity to go back to you when you first started out in stand-up comedy, and you said, avoid this one thing, you're going to make this, I mean, we all make a million mistakes when we first start out, like, you know, doing stand-up comedy. But if you had the opportunity to just give yourself one thing that you could avoid, don't do this. I'm going to give you, assuming that most of the things we do, even when they're mistakes, they lead, they're hopefully good lessons and they lead us to be better people and better performers and all those sort of things. But you just get one free one here where you just get to say, don't do this, whatever it is, that job, that gig, that mistake you made on stage, that thing you said, whatever it might be, just don't, you get to take one out. What is it?
Oh, you know what I would, I think, tell myself is, I would be like, don't do a solo show in Melbourne until you can really afford to go all in. Because I think I did it without any PR and without a producer and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't realize the kind of the ways that you can support yourself that are available to you, basically. and so, because like when I did a solo show in Edinburgh for the first time, you know, I'd been working away and I had enough money to invest in like PR and a producer, and I didn't, and there were people who were flying for me, so I didn't have to fly for myself. Because that is, yeah, days outside the front of the Melbourne Town Hall, checking on the app to see exactly how many tickets I've got with half an hour to go, and like trying to get people to see your show, which always, nothing puts you less in the mood for doing a show than 15 minutes before your show begging people to come and see it. Yeah, that would be one thing that I would change.
Good. That's a pretty good answer. I'll accept that as an answer to that question for sure. Good. If you could wake up tomorrow and you had any skill in the world, you don't have to do your 10,000 hours, and you can define skill however you would like to define that skill, but you just wake up and you have, like, you know, competency in being able to do something that you can't currently do, what would you like to be able to do?
Tennis. I would love to play tennis well. You know, people who socially go out and they play tennis with their friend. Like, and I keep making plans to play tennis with my friends, but it hasn't happened yet, and I'm kind of glad because I will be so bad at it. But my mum was a tennis player and we went to watch the ASB Classic this year, and it's so cool. It's such a cool sport.
I've always been one of those people who like admires houses that have tennis courts, despite the fact that I don't play tennis. Do you think that you would, like, if you were like a good tennis player, you would have a house that had a tennis court?
100%. Yeah. We had some like rich friends in Christchurch who had like her last name is a name of a company that everyone knows. At their wedding, we went and played on their tennis court, and the tennis court's right by the pool. And, you know, I was just like, that's but surely you would never be unhappy.
No, right? Yeah, that feels like a pretty good life. Yeah. I've often looked at those houses and thought I'd love to live in that house, despite the fact that I don't play tennis, which feels like a very unnecessary, like, you know, amount of your property to be dedicated to one thing if you don't actually play it. But I guess if I had a tennis court, I could learn to play tennis.
Yeah, and it means it's insurance, because if you ever have the impulse, it's not going to be right much there. Work to get out on the court. Right. What you want is a house with every single thing you might possibly want to try once.
Yeah, stayed at my sister's place. She has four kids and all her daughters are really good basketballers. And so in their backyard, they literally have like a half court proper basketball court, you know, like all been put in. It's so beautiful. It's so like, it looks like you're at Drake's house or something, you know what I mean? Like there's like half court basketball, and I stayed there during the comedy festival and dog sat for them. And I went out one day and like, you know, just like shot out the backyard, and I was like, oh, this is great. I'd love to live this life. And then could not lift my arm for 3 months. That was pretty
Yeah, that'll be me as well after one 15-minute social game of tennis where I don't land the ball within the lines once.
On my desk, I used to have a little, as close as I had to an inspirational saying, and it said, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? So I'm going to ask you that question. What would you attempt to do if success was guaranteed?
Oh. Enter Australian Idol.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What style of music would you be performing in Australian Idol? So fantasy scenario, you're great at singing, you enter Australian Idol. What's your kind of signature? Because they do covers on Australian Idol generally, don't they? Like, your performances are covers. So
yeah,
you come out and what are you singing, and kind of what take on this song have you like taken it in? Because often someone will reinterpret like a big hit song in their own individual style. So paint us a picture of what that looks like.
The genre would be kind of like emo rock, you know, Good Charlotte, Fall Out Boy, that kind of, or Panic of the Disco, you know, big guitars but theatrical vocals, and doing Beyonce songs, I think, in that style would be what I, because I used to watch the show and I thought I wanted to be a singer, but I didn't want to be a singer. I just wanted to get a touchdown from Mark Holden. You know, like, I just wanted the experience that they get on Idol when it goes well.
Just want the celebratory validation at the end rather than...
Yeah, I just want to see everyone jump to their feet at the end of the song.
Yeah. Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'll do plugs at the top, but let's do plugs again. So if people are listening in New Zealand, there's a new show coming, which is what you're currently developing. I guess New Zealand Comedy Festival, is that where you're going to do that, or are you going to tour it all over the place? What are you going to do with that show for people who are listening in New Zealand?
It'll be in Dunedin first in March, and then in Wellington and Auckland in May, and probably a few other places yet to be announced or figured out. But it's called Night Terror, and yeah, come see it.
Okay, but you are coming to Australia with the previous show, so tell people about that.
Yeah, so the show is called Daddy Short Legs. It's been, I first started doing it in 2021, but it won the Fred Award for Best Show at the New Zealand Comedy Festival, and I'm just doing 10 shows. I think it's the 9th of April to the 21st, maybe, at the Town Hall in the Flag Room.
I highly recommend people go and see that. It's been so nice to talk to you today, mate. I've got one more question before we go, which is this, very hypothetical. I have a time machine. I can take you forward or backward in time. But I need you, the only thing that I ask is you only use this for selfish reasons. You don't have to do something on behalf of the planet. You don't have to do something on behalf of the world. And as I always say, you do not have to go back and kill Hitler unless your greatest wish in life and desire in life, your passion project, is to go and kill Hitler, in which case I'm not here to stand in the way of your dreams. If you want to go back and kill Hitler, you can kill Hitler, but you don't have to, is my point. Mm. You can just do something selfishly for you. What would you like to do?
Dinosaurs. Yeah. I would go back and just maybe perch myself on a tree, bring enough packed lunches for a few days and just watch dinosaurs and how they act and who's eating who and whether they're fighting, and I really would love to see one.
Eli, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. It's been so lovely to talk to you. It's been such a lovely opportunity to dip back into your world and your career and see what you're doing now. I'm very excited. I'm hopefully going to get an opportunity to come and see your show because it sounds so fascinating. I would love to hear all about it. So thank you so much for joining the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. What a delight.
Listener.